All right, okay, I'm talking today with Mr. Cal Abrams, former outfielder and first baseman for the Dodgers and several other clubs. Cal, to get started, I'd like to, if possible, ask you, how did you actually get started playing baseball?
Well, I actually got started in high school. My last year with James Madison High in Brooklyn, New York, I happened to be a scout by the name of Joel Abate in the stands when I hit the longest home run in the history of Madison. And I was graduating that year, and he came up to me and he said, "How would you like to be a Brooklyn Dodger?" Well, I don't know if you're aware of it, but every human being, every male human being who was born and raised in the shadows of Ebbets Field always wanted one thing in life, and that was to be a Brooklyn Dodger. I was no exception.
Did you play like any little league or organized ball ground, or just play like some street ball with your friends and stuff like that at all?
No, I played, well, I was an all-around athlete. But in our day, there was no such thing as little league. We had stick ball, punch ball, and what have you, touch tackle. And I was good in all of the sports that I've tried. But my father says, "Cal, the most money is in baseball, so you're going to be a baseball player."
What positions did you play while you were in high school getting started? Did you play a lot of positions?
I was an outfielder primarily, but I also played first base, and believe it or not, I even have one win, no losses as a pitcher for the Dodgers.
That's great. Really? That's for the Dodgers?
Incredible. For the Brooklyn Dodgers, yes.
How did that happen?
We were 14 games ahead mid-season, and Charlie Dressen one day asked, Who knows how to pitch? Who would like to help preserve our pitches for the forthcoming pennant?" So I was always a kibitzer and a clown and a good for carefree. And I said, "I can pitch." He said, "All right, go on out there." Of course, I wasn't used to stepping down off a mound. And after I finished the game, I had like a Charlie horse. I was limping all day. I wasn't used to that.
How'd your arm feel after that?
No, my arm was fine. In fact, I did have a very good arm. Between Carl Ferrillo, who played right field, and myself, who played left, as good as Duke Snider was, our bullpen coach, Clyde Sukeforth, once made a statement that between Abrams and Ferrillo, they could cover the outfield. And that was a great compliment for me. My arm was good. Ferrillo's arm, well, I don't know if you know about the Redding rifle.
There goes stories.
And he played that 297-foot wall like nobody else could. And no one went from first to third on a base hit because he'd throw them out.
When you played your games for Madison High, was there a field right there you played in, or did you play a field revolving around the high school? How was that set up for you guys?
No, they had... Right next to our field was a dirt baseball field called St. Athanasius. And it's very funny because last week, I live in Miami, in Florida right now, and the Miami Herald was talking about the old days in Brooklyn, and apparently the fellow who was writing it was talking about East 2nd Street and Avenue M, where I live, the Claridge Theater, where I went into the movie house, James Madison, where I went, and it was like reliving my own life. Very, very strange.
Was there a specific person? You mentioned your dad, but was there someone else when you were a kid or as you were growing, as you got into high school, who kind of directed you into baseball?
My dad was my key. Right behind our home, we had a big lot with weeds and what have you, and he would call three or four of the kids that would stay out in the outfield, and he would pitch for hours while I batted, and then he had a catcher's mitt, and I would go on the mound and throw. So I got all of my initial work in baseball there. Then in high school, the manager and teacher, Artie Wunderlich, was a wonderful person who recently passed away, also gave me a lot of instruction and help. And I received a contract from Joe LeBate from high school for $75 a month to play in Olean in the Pony League, but the series was on. There was only 2 weeks left to the year, and I had to wait until the season was over. Unfortunately, the right fielder broke his leg running around in the rocks and the holes up in Olean, so they whisked me up there. I played 2 weeks, and then I was drafted in World War II at age 18 for 3 years. Now, when I came back out of the war, because I still had a contract with my initial, a name on it, I was a slave to that $75 a month. I could not go to any other team, so I had to stay with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
So you were acquired by the Dodgers. Joe LeBake was a scout that signed you right out of high school.
Right.
You went to Olean, then World War II, so you came back. Where did you go?
Okay. They all had Vero Beach spring training, all the minor league clubs. And because I was much older and stronger, they decided to skip C and put me in B, Danville, Illinois, in a 3-hour. I hit 337. So they decided to skip A and put me in double A, which was Mobile, Alabama, and I hit 345. So they decided to skip triple A and put me in the major league. But in Brooklyn, on that particular year, there were 13 outfielders trying out only for left field because Snyder and Ferrillo had that sewed up, center and right. Oh, Schumann, Sharman, Antonello, McCormick, Russell, Hermansky, myself, and a few other guys, I cannot remember their names. And Mr. Branch Rickey said, Cal, do me a favor, go down to the minor leagues, go back to Mobile, have a good year, and I'll get rid of a lot of outfielders. So I went back and hit 327. I came back up for spring training again. The same 13 guys were still there. He said, do me a favor, go back to Fort Worth, Texas. So I went down there. I hit 327. And he brought me up again. And then he said, go to St. Paul, Minnesota, because there was only 8 outfielders. And being the third time that I had been optioned down, the next time they recalled me, they cannot send me down anymore, either trade me or keep me. And as luck would have it, Carl Ferrillo got beamed by a pitch from Sal Magley, and they recalled me instantly from St. Paul. And the day I got there, I figured, well, this is my big chance. I'm now going to be a real Brooklyn Dodger. But Carl Ferrillo had a head. He was an Italian with a strong, strong head. Now he was playing the next day. So I sat on the bench in 49, waiting and waiting and waiting. And I was really wishing that I could have gone back to the minors, because I'm the kind of a person, as a leadoff man, I like to play every day. I like to get up 5 times, and I will get 2 hits or 3. But when you keep me out of a ball game, a little staleness falls into place, and you're not as sharp as you should be. And although I did have a good pair of eyes, I could tell a ball from a strike. So 49 went and left me, and 50 was my first real chance. And by the way, mid-July, I was hitting 477. And I was leading both leagues by well over 150 points. Jackie Robinson was second on the club. And the headlines, never forget them, Mantle, Schmantle, we've got Abrams, which I have in my scrapbooks. It was a great feeling, a wonderful era. And coming back off a hot road trip, mid-July, and coming back to play 3 days in Brooklyn with 100 relatives and 100 friends in the stand, I looked up at the scorecard, the lineup. I wasn't playing. And I never played a game the rest of the season except to pinch hit in the ninth inning with the bases loaded and 2 out. And I once went to pinch hit for Pee Wee Reese, who had 2 strikes on him, which is something I have never seen in the history of the game.
I haven't either.
Okay. Well, I didn't know at that time, because I was still basically a young, naive, innocent person. And I used to say, why are all these little things happening to me? I'm leading the league. I can end up with a 400 batting average easy, and I'm not playing anymore. Years later, I discovered that the manager, Charlie Dressen, really didn't want me to hit and be the club top person, but he wanted to win the pennant without me. He even let me pinch hit against a left-handed pitcher. I'm a left-handed batter. In those days, we had the two-platoon system. So I discovered now that he was giving me enough rope to hang myself. Instead of being the kind of a person I could look up to, you can guess the rest from that point on.
Speaking of managers, what manager did you play for that you most respected?
Well, let's put it this way. With the Brooklyn Dodgers, I played for three managers, Leo DeRocher, Bert Schotten, and Charlie Dressen. Charlie Dressen, I have to call him an anti-Semite. Bert Schotten was the kind old man of baseball who didn't even put a uniform on. He just sat in there with his clothes on, never did anything but put up a lineup, did never call for a steal or a hit and run. We did that on our own. I and Pee Wee Reese had our own signals. I would run from first on a hit and run. We played like no other team played. Everyone else was governed by a manager or a coach or whatever. And Leo DeRocher, I have to admit, was a super baseball manager. He knew the game. He was a rough and tumble. But there were certain things that he did that I cannot discuss that were very nasty. And I will never forget what he did to me at one point. But as I said, he was a good manager.
Well, and I didn't mean to limit that to the Dodgers, because I know you also played for Baltimore,
okay,
and for Chicago, and
Pittsburgh. Fine. My theory, right, my opinion, a manager does not win or lose ball games. In my estimation, a ball player does. The nine men on the field, regardless of who's the chief or of the tribe, is not the one who's winning or losing the game. He can't stop a man from making an error. It's the error that caused the loss, so it's that fellow who lost the game and not the manager. It's not because the manager had a man steal and he was thrown out at second, that if the man was faster, he would have been saved. You know, there's a lot of things. I played for Roger Hornsby, who was a superb baseball player, superb. He hit over 400. But he was not a manager. I played for Paul Richards, who was not only the field manager, he was the general manager too. Why? Because he was getting $40,000 from the front office for that and $30,000 for the coach. So he was doing two jobs in one. He was not a great manager. Jimmy Dykes, I respected this man. He was a great, great man. He did know the game. He was well-loved. I played for him in the Orioles. The last day of the season, I was hitting 299 point something. My first time up, I hit a triple that put me a little over 300. And we all would love to end up hitting 300. That's the magic charm. So standing on third base, I said to Jimmy, Mr. Dykes, do me a favor. Take me out of the lineup. Let's pull a Mickey Mantle's job here. Let me stay out and hit 300. And his answer was, with a smile, Cal, I don't care if you had two broken arms and two broken legs, you're playing the rest of this game. The next two times up, I almost killed the pitcher with two line drives that were knocked down and I was thrown out. So I ended up hitting below 300. I still respect the man, though.
You mentioned some of the time that you spent in the minor leagues. Can you give me a little insight into what life was like in the minors for you at that point in time?
Oh, my God. When I tell people of the things that I have seen in my 67 years of living, they don't believe what I saw. For example, going through Georgia after spring training, working our way north for exhibition games, riding in the bus with five black players sitting in the back of the bus, and stopping at a little cafe which we call a Greasy Spoon. The first sign you see outside the building, no niggers allowed. I would turn around to the guys and say, would you like a drink, a sandwich, can I get you anything? And they appreciated that. None of the other fellows ever had that common sense, is the word I'm looking for, to ask these fellows. All they were interested in is running into the bathroom, relieving themselves, and then getting a sandwich and a drink. We played an exhibition game in Fort Benning, Georgia, and another one on the way to Atlanta during a barnstorming in the winter. Now, Fort Benning, we had 35,000 soldiers watching the game. And Atlanta, we had a pre-sellout crowd of 15,000 people. And the minute we loaded ourselves onto the buses, there was a telegram. If Jackie Robinson arrives in Atlanta, he will be sniped from the ballpark sign, the Ku Klux Klan. We immediately turned the buses around, went home, and finished our barnstorming tour at that point. These are things that nobody knows about. And we worried, we were scared to death too.
How about for yourself being, as you said earlier, a Jewish guy? You mentioned playing in Mobile and in Fort Worth, Texas. How were the fans, the teammates, the front office personnel supportive of you because you were playing so well, or was there some anti-Semitism you had to struggle with there?
When I was up with the Dodgers, and one of the options down to the minor leagues was to play back in Mobile, and the newspapers had big headlines, Cal Abrams coming from the major leagues to help win ball games for Mobile Bears. So I was practicing in the outfield, and a farmer was sitting there. And he called me over. And I figured, I assumed he wanted an autograph. And he says, I read in the paper, you're a Jew. I said, yes, I am. He says, well, what are you, Jewish Protestant or Jewish Catholic? And I said, oh, my God, I'm in a territory here that doesn't, you know. That was in that era. Then when I played for Bobby Bregan in Fort Worth, Texas, my wife and I and first child flew down from New York in an 8-hour flight in those days, and the president of the club, Mr. Reeves, met us at the airport and was driving us in his limo back to town to go to the hotel to sleep. And we had to pass the ballpark, which was being played, the game at night. The lights were on and shouting hooray, hurrah. And he said, would you like to go in and see Bobby Bregan and the club and see what's going on? I said, if you don't mind, we're very tired, I'd like to get some sleep. We went to the hotel, and the next morning I came down to get the paper, and Bobby Bregan, our manager, was there, and we shook hands, and he says, Cal, this is crazy, but I have to tell you, we have to go on the road for 2 weeks, and the schedule was supposed to be at home for 2 weeks. I said, why are we going on the road? My wife is here with a baby, doesn't know a soul. He says, somebody burnt the ballpark down. All the metal, all the wood, everything burnt down to the ground. And this, I said, but you played a night game. Well, right after we finished the night game, somebody torched the stadium. And we had to go away for 2 weeks. While I was away for 2 weeks, they had a typhoon. They had levees breaking and water running through the Fort Worth town and bacteria, and my wife had to go for shots, and I couldn't believe this was happening. After all, we were little Brooklyn, New York people. Nothing like that ever happened. These are just some of the quaint stories that happened.
So overall, though, your teammates and stuff were pretty supportive. You didn't have any of that sort of...
No. We ball players, because we were Dodger minor leaguers, they played as Dodgers. I had some wonderful fellows. Carl Erskine was on my team. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Preston Ward, Toby Atwell, fellows who did have some time up in the big leagues also. George Schuber. Mm-hmm. And a few other people. Chuck Connors, the rifleman.
Yeah.
He was my roommate. We had a lot of fun. Oh, yeah. A lot of crazy things happened.
So in 49 was the first time that you really got a chance to spend some extended time with the ball?
50.
50 was the first time. But you were called up in 49 when he was beamed.
Right. He got beamed in 49.
Were you up there at the end of the year when you guys battled the Cards down in the last game of the season and beat them? Were you still with the team at the end of the year?
In 49? Yes.
And tell me a little bit, if you can, about...
I don't recall too much of 49, though, because I was disappointed in not playing. And all I was doing every day was getting dressed and sitting on a bench and waiting for something to happen that never happened. So I was really downhearted. And only by playing do I remember what was transpiring.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit. Sure, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, the Ebbets Field in those days was a colorful atmosphere.
Very.
Do you remember your first coming to bat at Ebbets Field?
I believe I got a walk the first time up.
What was your impression when you loved
Ebbets Field, because all the people, no matter where they were sitting, were so close to the ball plate they can almost touch them. You could hear people talking to you while you're at bat. We were not only a family as a team, but the people around us were also part of the family. And it was a wonderful relationship. But the people in Brooklyn are a very rare breed. They say out of the mouths of babes come pearls. We were playing in Brooklyn for 3 solid weeks, and after each game I'd come out, there would be at least 200 kids with the penny postcards waiting to get your autographs. And this one particular boy was always managed to be the first one. And, after 3 weeks I'm saying to myself, why does he need 21 Cal Abram? So I grabbed him before a road trip, and I said, why did you ask for my autograph 3 weeks in a row? He says, I needed 21 Cal Abrams to trade for one Carl Ferrello. These are the way our family... We had such a wonderful rapport. Another incident. We had what we call Happy Felton, not whole gang. You take 3 youngsters in the outfield before a game, practice with them, and pick one of the 3. For this, you get $50. The youngster, is allowed at that point to talk to a Dodger of his choice in the dugout, and whoever they talk to gets $50. So there's $100 that the TV people are giving away, or the Baby Ruth candy bar, and I never went on the show. Robinson was on 40 times, so that's $2,000. Hodges and Reese also. The last week of the season, they said, all right, Cal, you're going on. And I said, it's about time. And I went a whole... They showed me the 3 youngsters, and I said to one of them, I said, listen, I whispered in his ear, I'm going to pick you. Now, when they ask you who you want to talk to in the dugout, you say you want to talk to me. That way I get $100. So here I'm throwing the ball up and down, and finally Happy Felton says, who do you like, Cal? I said, oh, this youngster right here, what a pair of hands, great ball player. Oh, he's going to make a Brooklyn Dodger someday. He said, congratulations, son. Who do you want to talk to? He says, Carl Ferrello. I couldn't get $50 no how. I was one of the least priced ball players in the leagues in those days.
So you mentioned the Ebbets Field, your love for it. Was it your favorite park overall in the big leagues?
I believe it had to be, not because... The money was secondary. None of us ever did get money because Branch Rickey, as I said, had a heart of gold. He knew how to hide it. The highest price that I recall was 3 or 4 of the fellows making $40,000 at that time. And the lowest minimum was 5, and quite a few of us were making only 5. But he always drew 1 million people. And that's another thing I have to tell you about Ebbets Field and the Brooklyn people. Monday, if there was a ball game, it didn't matter. There was enough people in there to warrant 1 million people in a 29,000-seated ballpark. And that meant that they loved the game and they wanted it to go on. And when they moved out in 1957, a lot of hearts were broken. A lot of people were angry, and they still are. They still blame Peter O'Malley, who had nothing to do with it. It was his father, Walter O'Malley, who did it. And yet the Brooklyn people still dislike intensely Peter O'Malley, the O'Malley family.
When you got up to the big leagues, was there a player who kind of helped you out or took you under his wing at all, an established guy who kind of showed you the ropes at all?
No. As a matter of fact, I was considered a loner because, number one, the religion had something to do with it. Number two, as much as I liked all the fellas on the team, they were all clicked off. Hodges had his associate, Hermansky had his, Jackie Robinson had his, and I would be rooming on the road by myself because they had doubled up with other fellas. So I was more or less a loner. But I spoke Spanish, and Mr. Ricky decided that if he ever gets Spanish ball players, he would have them room with me so that I can teach them English while we were playing. And of course, as I said before, I enjoyed life. I was a happy-go-lucky person. I clowned around a lot. And I think that's what kept me going. The motivation was there by laughing a lot. Man one time said to me, a ball player from the opposing club said, "I wish I had your nose full of nickels." And I was leading off that day, and I said, "I wish I had it full of pennies, and I'd be a millionaire, and then get a base hit." This made me feel super, you know. But with the Spanish boys, we would go into a restaurant, and he would say in Spanish, "How do you get the waitress to come over, and I want apple pie with vanilla ice cream. I love that." So I said, "Well, her name is Screwball." She said, "Hey, Screwball. And when she comes over, you say, give me apple pie a la commode." And he'd yell it out, and she'd laugh, and the people around her laugh. So then he would look at me and say, "You know damn good. We're on the Pullman berths of a train," and he says to me, "as we're all going to retire, how do you say to the guy, good night, sweet dreams, I'll see you in the morning." And I would say something very nasty, and he would yell it out, and they would look at him, and again he would say, "You know damn good." And this is what kept me going.
You mentioned Branch Rickey. If you could tell me a little bit about some of your dealings with him personally, how were they?
Oh, terrific. Number one, 1 year I had a fair year, and we were going to spring training, and I decided I would wait until spring training to sign. Now, they gave us transportation on the train, Severo, and we got there. My wife and I put our luggage in the room. I walked across to his office. "Hello, Mr. Ricky, how are you? I'd like to sign a contract, but I'd like to talk to you first. I'd like a $500 cost of living increase. Not because I was a great ball player and had a good year, but because I need to eat. My family is starving to death." And he says, with no, his eyebrows, thick, bushy eyebrows still down, "Did you unpack yet?" I said, "No." He said, "Good, get back on the train, go back to Brooklyn and wait till I call you." I went back to my wife. I said, "May, I didn't sign." And he said, "Go back to Brooklyn and wait." My wife said, "Number one, I'll divorce you. Number two, we haven't got 10 cents to pay for our fare back. Number three, go kiss his big toe and sign for whatever he gives you." That's the way we had to play our games in those days. Not like today. No arbitration, no union, no nothing.
Tell me a little bit as a kid about the 50 season. It was a pretty exciting season, and the Dodgers had a very fine team, and you were had been playing quite a bit, as you mentioned earlier. And then there's that famous play in the last inning of the season where Richie Ashburn threw you out of the plate. If you could just give me some of your reminiscences about the season and that particular
play. Well, the season was going along very, very well, and we were very hot. We were doing a great job, but unfortunately we ended up tied with the Philadelphia Phillies. Now, the ninth inning, I got a base hit. Pee Wee Reese was to sacrifice me and bunted the ball so perfectly that he got a hit. Now, we had a man on first and second, nobody out, tie score, I'm the winning run, and next man up is Duke Snider. The catcher, Stan LaPata, gave Robin Roberts, the pitcher, to signal to pick me off at second base. That sign was flashed to the outfielder, Richie Ashburn, who immediately started to charge in to back up a bad throw at second, getting me so that I could not advance to third. Nobody knew about this except Richie Ashburn. Our coach, Milton Stock at third base, had seen the outfielders and their present positions, and then he was watching Duke Snider. And Roberts missed the pickoff sign and instead threw the ball home. Snider hit a line drive past my head, a shot. And I knew in my own mind that if everyone were playing his rightful position, I would have scored simple. I was very fast. I started on my horse, I'm running toward third base, and the first sign that Milton Stock had flashed was to go ahead with his right hand. Then when he discovered where Richie Ashburn was, when he spotted him, and seen that he had already thrown the ball home, and that the catcher already had the ball, he gave me a sign that I will never forget the rest of my life. He put his fingernails of his left hand in his mouth while he gave me a half sort of a go-ahead sign from third. I had already rounded the base as hard as I could, and when I got like 10 to 20 feet past third base, here was a catcher up the baseline with the ball. I could not stop and go back. I was out. So the only thing I could do was run into him and try to knock the ball out. Unfortunately, I didn't, and I was out. Carl Frillo got up and popped a foul for the second out. And then Gil Hodges hit a long fly up against the wall for the third out, which I could have scored from third base had I stopped at third, and we would have won the game. In the 10th inning, top of the 10th, Dick Sisler hit a home run over my head, and when we got up, we couldn't catch them, and that's the way that season ended. So I lost some money that year. The next year, the same thing happened with the Giants, and Bobby Thompson hit a home run against Ralph Branca, so I lost some more pennant and World Series money. And the year after that, 1952, in the middle of the season, they traded me to Cincinnati and won the pennant, so I lost 3 years in a row. As I said before, money does not agree with me.
But after you traded, you had one of your finest seasons after that.
Yes, after the seasons, and I started playing for different ball clubs, they were good enough to say, well, Cal, you're worth a little more, so we're giving you this and this. And so I did make a few extra dollars as I proceeded through Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, and the Chicago White Sox. When I reached the White Sox, I was there 2 weeks, and they told me that I was going to play center field because they knew I was a great center outfielder, and I liked it because the White Sox were always a pennant contender, and there I could get some extra cash. Unfortunately, they bought Larry Doby from Cleveland. They called me in the office, and they said, well, Cal, look, we can only keep one of you. If you were the owner, who would you keep? I said, I would keep the leadoff man because he gets on first base, he's got good eyes, he's fast, and he can score runs. And they said, that's true. But a home run hitter is what the people would rather see. So unfortunately, I was sent to Miami. Larry Doby had the worst year in home run production that year. And not that I was happy. I mean, here I was in the minors again. And I could see the handwriting on the wall that there's no way in the world I was going to go back up into the major league. And the condition that arose at that point, which made me decide to retire, was when the minor league club came to me and said, you're a great ball player, but we can only offer you X number of dollars in the minor league. And I says, I have a family. I cannot take this after making a much more, profitable amount of money. So that's when I voluntarily retired. And because I was nice enough to get out of the game gracefully, I've been rewarded with little perks now and then. But the true perks have come 35 years after I left, and such as coming to the old-timer game here today, getting on cruises and doing baseball talk. So I'm very happy with what my life has set out to be, and I'm happy doing what I'm doing now.
How was it when you were traded from the Dodgers to Cincinnati, being with a club that was always a pennant contender, going to, I believe Cincinnati at that time was a sixth place club? Did that really shock you? Was that like a blow to your psyche at all, or
no?
Play.
No, there was a situation there that nobody really understood. First of all, Branch Rickey left the Dodgers and went to the Pirates. Branch Rickey had already put a $1 million price tag on me for sale a long time ago. So when he called the Dodgers, they said, fine, we'll sell him to you. Give us $1 million. He said, you're crazy. I'm not going to give you $1 million for Callahan. Well, he called Gabe Paul in Cincinnati and said, if you buy Cal Abrams, I promise you I will make a big trade with you in the winter, which happened. But the funniest thing is, I'm playing in Cincinnati. We got three games. First day, I put my Dodger uniform on. I go out. I do a good job. Second day, I do the same thing. Third day, I'm putting the uniform on. Somebody taps me on the shoulder. Take the uniform off, go next door, we just traded you. That's the way they did business in those days. So now I'm playing with Cincinnati. They said, you'll play right field for us. I'm in right field. Ted Kaczuski was our first baseman. I have to tell you this one incident, which makes me feel good. And Jackie Robinson got up. He hit a line drive to me on a base hit. And it was one of those perfect jobs where the ball gets into your glove very quickly, and I didn't care who was watching. I decided this might be an error, it might be the wrong thing to do, but I know what Jackie Robinson does. He rounds the base hard, he can stop on a dime. If you bobble the ball, he can continue. I took the ball without thinking, and I flung it as hard as I could directly at Ted Kaczuski. The ball hit him in the chest hard. And it rolled on the ground. It didn't bother him, though. He's so strong. Meanwhile, Jackie had stopped on a dime, and when he knew he was out, he was scrambling to get back. Of course, he was safe because Kaczuski was watching to see that he touched the bag. And when he got himself up and brushed himself off, he turned around, looked at me in the outfield, and his pearly white teeth were flashing, and I knew he was talking to me, saying, you're a goddamn good ball player. It was an honor. And a good feeling that I got. But as I said, I didn't know I was going to Cincinnati. It was really to go to Pittsburgh. And true to his word, I did end up with Pittsburgh at the end of the season, and he traded me for Gus Bell, who was a heck of an outfielder.
What was it like when you went into Pittsburgh at that point in time? They were, again, another team that was struggling. How did you get a chance to play a lot with them? And tell me a little bit about Fred Haney, if you would.
Fred Haney was a wonderful guy. He was okay. We had Ralph Kiner there. We had Frank Thomas. And I had a wonderful relationship with the ball club and the people. We made some great friends in Pittsburgh. But that wasn't to be my home for the rest of my baseball era. Although I hit .280... and had 15 home runs as a leadoff man. So when I went into Branch Rickey again and said, I'd like some more money, he would look down at the statistics and said to me, quote, I can't give you more money because you hit 15 home runs. I didn't ask you to be a home run hitter. You're a leadoff man. I wanted you on first base. And that's what happened.
You're a leadoff hitter. Could you describe to me your hitting style?
Okay. I was the type of a hitter who didn't break his wrist until the last moment. That way my bat was always level and going through this way, and then I broke my wrist. Therefore, when the bat met the ball, it was slightly on an angle that the ball would ricochet toward center, left center, and left. A lot of people would say, Cal is not a pull hitter, but he's getting his base hits by hitting to the center and left side of the field. One year in Fort Worth, I was batting .384 at the end of the season with a month to go. And Mr. Rickey flew down And he said, "Cal, I want you to be a home run hitter. I want you to play. You're going to be in Ebbets Field. It's a short right field fence. I want you to turn your whole body around and face the pitcher, literally face him. And when that ball comes, I want you to pull it." It was such a hard situation for me to stand this way, looking at a pitcher and still pull the ball. I was missing it. I was striking out. And with maybe 20 days left, my average dropped way down. I said, "That's it. I'm going back to my old stance." And I ended up hitting 327. Got my hits one after another.
What was your strategy as a leadoff hitter? To really work the pitcher, get him deep in the count, or just look for whatever you could do? What was that sort of strategy?
Well, as I said once before, I did have a good pair of eyes. And the umpires, knowing this, bore down a little better than they would with the average ball player. If a ball was 2 inches inside, they knew it was a ball, and I was taking it, it was a ball. And they knew that if it was a strike and I didn't swing, they're going to call it a strike. But I was not a guess hitter. And for this reason alone, I never swung at foolish, stupid pitches like I have seen so many times in the past. If a man is thinking fastball with two strikes and the pitcher throws a curve in the dirt and the man swings at it, to me, that is not a good ball player. That is not a good ball player, and it don't deserve $2-3 million. But I very, very rarely ever swung at a pitch in the dirt. And I very rarely swung at bad pitches. The only time I would swing at a bad pitch was when there was a super, super speed and the ball was rising. We had a few fellas that could throw hard, Bob Fella. And if they threw it like letter high, if I stepped into the ball and swung, it wasn't letter high anymore, it was shoulder high. And then I said, "Okay, from now on, watch that rising, watch the step, and you will not swing at that." I talked to myself. And I considered myself a good hitter, not a great hitter, because if I was a great hitter, I would have been pulling balls also.
What was your strategy on an 0-2 pitch? Anything special?
Two strikes. Well, if you started out, let's say the pitcher started out with a curveball, and it was a strike, and then he threw another curve, it was a strike. The next pitch, no matter what it was going to be a waste. Could be a fastball on the outside part of the plate, or a good curve. But very rarely can the guy get three strikes in a row on three curves. I don't know too many pitchers that can do that. So now it's 2-1, 1-2. Next could be a fastball. I might swing and foul it off. Next pitch could be a slow curve, which I would time and punch over the left, over the shortstop's head. I don't try to kill a ball. I don't try to hit home runs. And yet in Little Rock, I hit a 600-foot home run. It was, of course, in those days we had what they call a 98 baseball, and the air in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is very clear and crisp, and the balls travel an awful long way there.
How about on a 3-0 pitch back then, being a leadoff hitter? Would they ever turn you loose, or
no,
were you always looking?
No, 3-0, they did not want me to hit, and there were a lot of times that I had quite a few walks. I was a walker and a singles hitter. Eddie Stanky, who preceded me, was a superhero because he would, with two strikes, keep punching the ball foul until he finally got a walk. I didn't have to do that. I had the eye and I had the hitting ability, so I wasn't worried about that. I was also very fast, and I knew a lot of times when I hit a Baltimore chop to the shortstop, I'd have a base hit. Not like today. I see them thrown out by two steps. So I figured, well, these fellows are getting so much money, they're eating so much, they're so big and strong, they can't run as fast as we did because we were hungry.
How about once you were on base, did they give you the green light to steal a lot? Was that part of your game strategy?
When I played with the Brooklyn Dodgers, we as a family would give our own signs. Pee Wee Reese would give me a sign by picking his nose, and I would run on a hit and run, and he hit the ball to second base. Duke Snider and Reese and Hodges, they had their own signs too. There has never been a ball club, as far as I know, where the baseball player himself was the manager, where the whole team did their own hit and runs, taking, hitting, so on and so forth. And today it's so obvious where the coach at third looks into the dugout, he gets a sign. Maybe the manager isn't giving it because everybody's watching the manager, so he has a man with a towel around his shoulders over sitting on that end of the bench giving the signs, and it's fluctuating from back, forward, and all this. To me, it's ridiculous. And it isn't necessary for the manager to, you know, all right, take this one. It's not right. We did our own thing. Also, when a man is on second base, if he can catch the catcher's signs, we would give the sign to the batter, this is a fastball, or this is a curveball. Because there are quite a few ball players who cannot hit fast pitches and curveballs. You know, they're off stride. So if he knew a fastball was coming, he would get into it better.
Do you feel that, I don't even know if you had him back in your day playing, like a hitting coach or your manager or something like that, could they help you or hurt you as a hitter once you made the pros during your time?
No. The only one that hurt me was Branch Rickey that one year by turning me around to face right field. Other than that, no one had ever come to me because, in all honesty and modesty, I was a hitter. I hit well enough. I was like a Pete Rose when he hit the left field, because he could hit the right field too. But as the years went by, I started to pull a few balls. I hit a couple of home runs deep in right and right center field, and I was very happy to do it. I guess maybe it was because it was a changeup or a pitch off stride pitch to get me off balance, but I did it. And
what do you think causes a slump for a major league hitter?
I don't think that there can ever be a true answer to that. It's just going constantly every day, day in, day out. You know, sometimes you can overtrain for a fight. Sometimes you can be playing too much and you're over. There's something about you that is missing. 1/1000th of an inch. Could be the eyes, it could be the wrist, it could be the swing, it could be the stance. I went to one ball club, I believe it was Detroit, and when I was leading off, I touched the plate, looked at the pitcher's mound, and I said, hey, this rubber is a little cockeyed. And everybody told me I was wrong. But then when they looked, it was, sure enough, the rubber is there, straight ahead, but the point of home plate was facing almost like shortstop. And when I stood at that plate, I was very uncomfortable. And the umpires were calling certain balls strikes when they were really balls. So I made sure that they knew, and I had them turn it around. You feel things. You sense things.